3246, Paul. Whoever's up for that. The House Committee on Revenue for April 1st, 2015 will come to order. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3246. And I think Kyle is going to describe the bill for the committee. Thank you, Kyle.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, member of the committee. House Bill 3246 would establish an exemption for qualifying new property or new improvements to property that increase energy efficiency of the property or reduce greenhouse gas emissions for the property. New or improvements to property must qualify for any form of tax relief or ratepayer incentives in Oregon, and improvements to property must improve a property's home energy performance score. For commercial buildings, newer improvements to property must qualify as home, or qualify as, excuse me, energy conservation measures. The bill specifies the calculation for the amount of the exemption, which essentially is the property be valued with the energy efficiency property, and compare that to the value of the property without it, and that difference between the two, if there is one, would be the value of the exemption. The bill requires the Department of Revenue to adopt rules for administration of the exemption, and it would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2016.
Thank you very much. And I noticed that we are blessed with a large delegation from Multnomah County today, so why don't we start with them?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Can I ask that Chloe Peterson from Representative Peterson?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay.
Chloe, come up.
Thank you.
Representative Vega Peterson is not available today, so her LA is going to present for her. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for traveling down the freeway to see us today. And welcome back, Mr. Assessor.
As the representative.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart. Member of the committee. For the record, my name is Chloe Becker. I'm a legislative assistant for Representative Vega Peterson, and as she is not here to testify today, she asked that I read these remarks for her. House Bill 3246 grants a property tax exemption to energy conservation measures, ensuring that owners who retrofit their properties to save energy are not penalized by the resulting increased value of their property. This legislation is modeled on an existing law that supports solar and alternative energy installations by ensuring the value of new installations is not taxed and expands that concept to energy efficiency. When the concept of a property tax assessment exemption for energy efficiency was brought to our office by the Home Performance Guild of Oregon, it covered only retrofits to existing homes. Through consultation with Multnomah County, it became clear that the need was for the exemption was much broader, and so we expanded it to include all property, commercial as well as residential. It will help encourage commercial and residential property owners to make upgrades that will ultimately benefit our entire region by providing new jobs, saving energy, which reduces the need for expensive new generation facilities, and reducing the burning of fossil fuels that contribute to climate change. We're in the midst of an attrition of tax and ratepayer incentives for energy efficiency, and this narrow fix ensures that we are incenting the most impactful energy measures. The market, as represented by the Home Performance Guild, wants a market-based incentive for homeowners to make energy efficiency upgrades to their homes. Time of sale valuation of energy efficiency and high-performance home features would firmly establish a market incentive. This legislation, along with previous home energy performance score legislation that was passed in 2013, established certification standards for issuing energy rating on homes, and this would collectively signal to the market that energy efficiency has broad and lasting value. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jules Bailey, Multnomah County Commissioner, and you thought you were rid of me. It's a real pleasure to be back in front of you today in the very first committee I've had a chance to testify in front of as commissioner. And I do have to say this 1 o'clock thing, after six sessions of showing up at 8 a.m. for revenue every day, I guess I missed my opportunity. But thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I appreciate it. Multnomah County strongly supports House Bill 3246, and we're very excited at the opportunities that it presents. fundamentally, this is local government here asking you to give us a tool that will allow us to create jobs and to improve our built environment through energy-efficient upgrades to commercial and residential buildings. House Bill 3246 is pretty straightforward. At its core, it removes a disincentive. Multnomah County is embarking on a commercial property assessed clean energy program, or CPACE, as it's sometimes called for short. The CPACE program is one in which Multnomah County, and in partnership with City of Portland and private lenders, will work with private building owners to offer low-cost financing for their upgrades of their commercial buildings. One of the challenges is that when we embark on that program, that when commercial building owners then install large energy efficiency measures, there is the potential that our good assessor, Mr. Walruff, and his team have to come in and then ding them essentially for the energy efficiency that they're installing. And as it is often marketed, as you remember from many discussions in this committee, energy efficiency is often predicated on the idea that in over a period of time, it will pay for itself, that you have a installation that is going in that is saving a building owner money. If we disincent that by then creating this additional barrier of property tax that goes on top of it, what we're doing is reducing that ability for the energy efficiency measure to pencil, and we are creating a disincentive to installing it, making it likely that that wouldn't have been installed in the first place. So we as local government don't see it as foregoing revenue. We see it as creating an opportunity to create more projects that are out there that then gets more valuable buildings on the tax rolls in the future after the exemption has expired. The fact is we have picked a lot of the low-hanging fruit in energy efficiency, and now it's time for us to really look at new tools that give local governments the ability to work with building owners for these kinds of improvements. As this committee well knows, we have scaled back many of the incentives that we have, and for good reason. We no longer have the kind of robust incentives that this state once offered. But we at the local level can work to be able to ensure that not only do we have an incentive, but that we are removing barriers for private building owners to be able to upgrade their buildings and create the kind of built environment that supports the city and county climate action plan and that supports job creation in the Portland metropolitan area. And I want to, we have Randy Walruff here from the County Assessor's Office. You're well familiar with him. He can help answer any technical questions that you have. There is an amendment that is coming that the assessors are working on, so we will have a complete bill ready for you. But we stand ready to do this. And it dovetails also nicely off of a bill that this chamber passed, this body passed, House Bill 2801 last session, that instructs assessors to be ready to be able to evaluate energy efficiency in buildings. So assessors do have this capability. And with that, Mr. Chair and committee, I will end my testimony and take any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Walruff, do you want to be heard?
I'll be here for technical questions. I would just echo that I've been meeting with the assessors.
And for the record.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Representative Barnhart, committee, I'm Randy Walruff, Multnomah County Assessor and Tax Collector. Thank you. I'm here today to answer any technical questions you have and to let you know that we are working on the amendment, as Commissioner Bailey referenced. It's going to be pretty short and concise. We've consulted already with the Department of Revenue, the proponents, and I've been having ongoing discussions with the assessors to hopefully address their concerns about how they would implement this. And I have a follow-up meeting with them and a call-in on Friday, and been meeting with AOC and some other stakeholders. So with that, I'll answer technical questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Oh, Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all very much for being here. I'm actually going to speak in support as a co-sponsor of the bill. I won't take the time to get up to the dais, but as one who's assisted building owners in my practice and knows many of them in the Portland area, I can speak that we are talking about very close dollars and cents when it comes to making the investment for large commercial buildings in energy improvements. And most of the time, it comes down to, will this literally pencil out in the dollars and cents over a few years? And anything we can do to remove a barrier to encourage building owners to continue this, because it is happening. I've had many clients do it, and people who aren't clients do it. But I can tell you it's a very thin line, and anything we can do to assist, I'm very supportive of.
Thank you. Representative Bence, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the bill. I guess the question to the assessor is going to be how difficult and how much more work to do the work that's reflected in Section 3.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bence. In Section 3, that has actually been the subject of much conversation with assessors. That's why one of the amendments is going to be that, number one, we're taking out the rulemaking that the Department of Revenue is going to need to do, because other than adopting an application form, part of that amendment will be that the application will need to be in advance of the work commencing. So, therefore, the applicant will be providing the information for, if the job is solely an energy efficiency job, it'll be fairly straightforward. What this does is this says that the amount of the exemption is equal to the positive market influence. In a lot of small jobs, it's not possible to measure in the market that there is any increase. So under Measure 50, even if we increase the market value, there wouldn't have been an exception to the MAV, the maximum assessed value, due to the $10,000 in 1 year or $25,000 or 5 years limits in the statutes already. So for bigger jobs, though, and many times this work could be part of a much larger retrofit, many times, whether it's a home or an apartment complex or commercial building, they're doing a total gut and stuff. So with the application in advance and submitting their cost, they would be submitting the total cost of the job and the cost of the work specifically attributable to the energy efficiency improvements. And the bill is written so that there's various ways to show that to the assessor up in Section 1, whether it qualifies for tax relief or ratepayer incentives, whether it improves the energy performance score, which I believe that subsequent people testifying today can talk about, and that's for properties 3 units and under, or what's already defined in our statute under 469860, energy conservation measures for commercial buildings, where it's laid out there. So when they turn that information in and we have that, then one example I give is someone's doing a $500,000 remodel. As part of that, that's their cost. As part of that, they're spending $50,000 on the energy enhancements. So that's 10%, if my math is right. We appraise the property, and we already have to appraise the property due to Measure 50 twice. We appraise the property with the work done, and we appraise the property without the work done. Assessors around the state have different ways they do that. Some just take last year's value, roll it forward, come up with a new value. So if the new value, and as we know many times, retrofits, you don't get all the dollars back in market value. So my example is $400,000 increase in value for a $500,000 job. Since the energy efficiency improvements are 10% of the total, their exemption would be 10% or $40,000. So it's proportional to how the market changed on this, and that's how this is written here. My one other example I have is I had a case about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was an apartment complex, and the taxpayer truly did do a straight-up renovation. And in the end, the taxpayer was quite upset because we ended up having to add $80,000 exception event to his property because we appraised the property with the work done. He'd spent $120,000. If this bill had passed, though, his $80,000 would have been exempted for 10 years, and then it would come back on the tax roll. I hope that answers your question.
Please, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so, yeah, for the record, I was actually referring to Section 1, Paragraph 3, rather than Section 3. The question, though, is if this bill passes, do you have to do any more than would have been the case without it, and if so, how much?
Yes, we would have to do more. And that's been part of my conversation with assessors. My office looks at this very similar to the historic exemption, and we have a rehabilitation property exemption for residential property in Multnomah County, and we actually have a number of exemptions. So by getting the application in advance and doing this work, we will have to create an exemption file in our office, and it will get put into our system and tracked for 10 years.
Yes, please.
And so the reflection here of having to find two real market values, am I hearing that you're already doing that so you don't have to do any more when it comes to actual appraisal work? Because when I read this, it looks like you have to subtract from the real market value with the energy efficient improvement an amount equal to the real market value of the property if it had not been added. So I was trying to figure out how in the world you avoided having to appraise the house twice.
Well, I would love to not have to appraise houses twice and properties twice, but Measure 50 requires me to. Because when anyone does any work to their property, we are basically action-driven. The six-year reappraisal cycle no longer exists. So we are always out there looking for changes, and permits are our main way of finding those. So when we show up at the job, and unfortunately many times it's after the work's been done, which makes it somewhat problematic to guess what it looked like before the work was done. But to answer your question, we appraise the property with the work done. We have to have a value without it. We have to extract out of that what is the market value attributable to the improvement so that we can add that times the change property ratio to their maximum assessed value. What this bill seeks to do is to exempt them for 10 years from that process. In order to determine the exemption, we need to appraise it just like we do now.
Yes, please.
Yep. And if the house sells in that 10 years, let's say 5 years into the term it sells, what does a new buyer enjoy the same exemption?
At this point, it is an exemption for 10 years with no clawback or no cancellation upon sale of the property. So my answer at this point would be yes. It's a 10-year exemption.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And that would be true even though the market value of the house may have improved as a result of these energy efficiency or CO2 reduction activities.
That's correct. Now, various assessor offices have various ways due to their computer systems of tracking their current exemptions and how they put them in their system. Some have to create a sub-account already. We have a system which is close to 30 years old in technology. We create a partial exemption within our system, whether we can do a lump sum amount or a percentage amount.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
Hi.
Hello.
I was wondering if you can give us some sort of idea what the estimated total loss of property tax revenue to the counties would be during the 10 years that you're looking at for the property exempted under this bill. Statewide.
Chair Barnhart, representing Whitsitt. As to that question, we're talking about property that does not exist at the moment. So it would be hypothetical. I think that what you would be wanting to say is a but for. If but for this amendment, House bill, would this work already occur and would we be taxing it? I believe Representative Davis just discussed his aspect on that from his experiences. So I believe that this is similar to many incentive programs, that your thoughtful consideration is that this is worth the future revenue that will come in after the 10 years expires.
Could I follow up?
Yes, please. Yeah.
So would this apply to the data centers that we're looking at having come into the state now, would they qualify under this as a property tax exemption because they all have green energy, basically?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, this bill is narrowly focused to look at upgrades that are based around energy efficient improvements. So if a data center came into Oregon, located in Oregon, and said, hey, we're going to buy green power, for example, that wouldn't qualify under this definition here, under this statute. What we're looking at are homes or buildings that are going through a retrofit process that then add energy efficient components to it. And that increment of the energy efficient component is what would be exempt, not the entire structure, not the company, not green energy purchases, those sorts of things.
Okay. I guess my question would be, why wouldn't they build these in to start with? You know, if you're talking about buildings that haven't been built yet, and then you're talking about remodeling buildings that haven't been built yet, I'm not understanding why they wouldn't initially put these energy efficient devices or whatever in them before they build them or as they build them.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, perhaps I can clarify a little
okay.
bit. When when Mr. Walworth is talking about the but-for, maybe these wouldn't be built, we were referring to just that retrofit around energy efficiency. So this is in buildings, for example, that already exist. And we, in, through our analysis of, for example, the Multnomah County Commercial CPACE program, our sweet spot on commercial buildings is like 25 to 50,000 square foot buildings, say, for example, in the Central East Side industrial area. These are structures, many of which have been around for a very long time. They were built in the early 1900s. They don't necessarily have an energy manager that's tasked with figuring out their energy use. We can provide a service to them to help them get access to capital to do energy efficiency in their building, but these aren't big companies that have a the ability to absorb, you know, unlimited amounts of energy efficiency that's going into the building. So they're doing a very tight calculation about whether or not it makes sense to put in some additional insulation or upgrade their HVAC system for energy efficiency. The challenge is when we're talking to them about doing that, we don't want to sort of assist them with one hand and club them with the other and say, hey, it's a good thing to upgrade your building for energy efficiency, and then coming around on the back end and say, oh, but by the way, that efficiency you just put in, we're going to ding you for that on your property taxes. So this allows us that 10 years to help that pencil out a little bit more, and it is our theory that a lot of these projects wouldn't happen for those upgrades but for this removal of a disincentive.
I just want to make one last comment. So could we assume that the dollars that we're not going to take in property tax revenue from this proposed bill would otherwise be going to schools and other things that we need in our counties?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, keep in mind, please, that these are local property tax revenues. So there would be a portion that would go to services, and certainly Multnomah County, we rely on property taxes, and we wouldn't be here in front of you today if we didn't believe that there was an opportunity here to improve our building stock and improve our ability to provide services for our constituents. The theory here is that by removing a disincentive, we'll get more projects that wouldn't have happened otherwise, and at the end of that 10-year exemption, we'll have some additional property tax revenue coming in from a building stock that's more robust, while at the same time achieving some of the job creation goals that we would like to do. But because this is only on new energy efficiency improvements, we're not reducing in any way the revenue that Multnomah County has right now for being able to provide services that we consider critical for human services and for other programs.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again, Mr. Former Representative.
Good to see you. Recovering Representative.
Is there, you know, different topic.
Yeah.
I know you've been an active proponent of CWO over the years, and it's Clean Energy Works Oregon. I wonder if you might talk about any benefits that CWO might realize in their business model from passage of this legislation.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, it's a good question, and I believe we'll have somebody from the Home Performance Guild of Oregon coming up to testify, and they are in partnership with Clean Energy Works. I should say very clearly that while I've been talking mostly about the commercial side of the equation, I should give great credit to the Home Performance Guild for bringing this concept forward, and we are in full support of the residential side of this as well, too. We just happen to have a program that's more focused on commercial, which is why I've been talking about that aspect of it. On the residential side, well, it's interesting. You should. We were having this conversation now. My wife and I actually just put an offer in on a home in Portland that has we found out through the disclosure process no insulation in the walls at all. So I'm going through the math in my mind of, oh man, what's that going to cost? And are we going to get dinged later on by Randy here? So there is definitely a component for this for residential owners as well. With regards directly to Clean Energy Works, to your question, Clean Energy Works would not benefit directly from this legislation. It would be more on the just the demand side for energy efficiency. We would hopefully have more homeowners that are interested in upgrading their homes. It would remove that disincentive, and no direct money would flow to Clean Energy Works, but there would theoretically be additional work out there from being able to market the fact through contractors and through the Home Performance Guild that this is an energy efficiency improvement that will not negatively impact homeowners.
Follow up.
Yes, please, follow up.
Thank you. Along with that, obviously you had a long tenure on House Energy and Environment and so forth, but I don't see any sideboards in here. Maybe they will be coming in further amendments or rules or whatever, but, you know, there are all kinds of energy improvements and modifications or enhancements mm-hmm. that could be done, but I don't see anything in here that actually tries to prioritize and make sure that whatever it is we might be extending some sort of tax abatement for is really effective in terms of minimizing energy use or conservation and stuff. Would you favor some sort of sideboards on that to make sure that whatever the property owner is trying to receive some benefit for actually will be effective in being an efficiency measure?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, it's a great point. And when we first got into this discussion about structuring the bill, one of the concerns that was brought up was, well, gosh, how do people assess what is and what isn't energy efficient? I mean, if a homeowner, say at an extreme end, right? If a homeowner put granite countertops in and somehow claimed that the reflection from the granite countertops was lowering their ability to need to use lighting and that was energy efficient, right? Would the assessor then have to make a decision about whether or not that granite countertop was energy efficient, whether or not to give an exemption for that? So we have in the definition here a link to existing sort of methodologies of determining what is and what isn't energy efficient. So we'll be relying on the existing third-party definitions of what are energy efficient items. So there's that sideboard that's in there, as well as the fact that when we look at the effect of that then on market value, it's really only going to translate into value if it actually has value of for energy efficiency to the home. So that those two pieces together sort of create, by definition, some walls around what could and couldn't happen. If there's an interest in further clarifying what that is, we'd be happy to engage in that discussion.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? I'm in the middle of looking up ORS 469.703 because I hadn't studied that before. I guess I'm interested in what kinds of things you might be thinking about. I think about your old house mm-hmm. that you're looking at. We bought an old house many years ago. It was built in 1926. It had no insulation in the walls. The Eugene Water Electric Board came along and poked holes in the walls and dumped a bunch of insulation into the wall. The idea was that it was going to save energy. It didn't save any energy. What it did do was make the house a whole lot more comfortable. And that was a value to us, but it didn't, in fact, save energy. But that was the argument that they made in favor of it. So I'm interested in how we would figure these things out. I assume many houses still have heating oil furnaces. You replace the heating oil furnace with a heat pump. It certainly reduces the amount of energy used for, and it reduces the greenhouse gases, even in a place where a lot of the electricity is generated by coal. Would that qualify under this bill as an improvement? That would qualify for this property tax abatement, for example, those kind of things.
Did you want to take that?
Chair Barnhart, to answer that question, I think the proponents will tell you that a number of the improvements that they do on residential property are already not being picked up as exception events by the assessor. When you talk about just insulation on an older home, my appraisers do not have the matrix. It doesn't change the dial when it's just one item or a couple little items. Again, we have that $10,000 threshold right now, and you can spend $10,000-$15,000 on it, but to prove it in the marketplace is difficult. So those are the small jobs that I don't believe that this bill will assist. It's the bigger jobs, and like that apartment complex I was talking about, but also large homes or homes that need a total renovation. If your 1923 home needed to basically be done from the inside out, then you could have probably been a good candidate to apply for this. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
I would just add, Mr. Chair, that you bring up an interesting point, that as we talk about this, especially in the residential context, while we often talk about the dollars and cents of energy efficiency, this is also about just improving people's comfort in their homes and giving them an opportunity to feel a little less drafty in the evenings. So.
Will you or somebody else be able to provide us additional information on the but-for test? This bill asks for 10 years. Is that the right number? Why would it be the right? Can we demonstrate that that's the right number? Should it be variable based on some criteria? How is it that this bill will accomplish what we need with as little efficiency loss as possible? Obviously, on any bill like this, as you very well know, we will be giving a tax break under this bill for people who would have done exactly what they did anyway. There may be other people who would not have done what they did, especially in big commercial buildings. How do we tell, and how do we know that this is the right number?
Chair Barnhart, that's a great question. When we crafted this bill, we modeled it after the existing exemption for solar. So there is already this program for solar. We looked to extend it to energy efficiency, and that was where a lot of the reasoning behind it came, around extending certainty and leveling that playing field. If you would like additional information on that, we'd be happy to get it to you. I think the question around variability and those sorts of things, I'll speak for Randy, and you can kick me if I'm wrong, per usual. But I think from our perspective, we would want something that isn't going to be too cumbersome for assessors to be able to track and figure out. We would want something that's pretty uniform and that's going to be easy for them to know the rules of the game and go in and figure out and track. So I think we'd be in favor of something simple. Within that simplicity, is it 7 years? Is it 10 years? Is it something different? To some degree, that's a matter of taste and preference. But we believe that's a length of time that will match up well with, for example, the kind of financing that people get to do this. You know, a large commercial operator might take out a 10-year loan to do this, and so we want to make sure that the period matches the period in which they're going to be paying it back in order to remove that disincentive. So we think 10 years is sort of that Goldilocks. It's not too short. It's not too long.
All right. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, and I have to admit, this is a strange reversal. I'm just reflecting on conversations over the past 7 years that go kind of like this. Gosh, how much? I think, in fact, I'm channeling a question you ask at some point.
I'm looking forward to this.
and it kind of goes. Of the dollars that are going to be invested in energy efficiency improvement, how many come from the individual and how many from other government programs, other government incentives? So what we end up having is an opportunity to tax the very money that we, as a state, invest in these improvements. But we don't. Instead, we carve them out under the mistaken assumption based upon the chair's remark about but-for. And so this takes us back to a chapter in our history labeled Betsy, where we realized how many different programs were stacking up and people were actually getting checks from us over and above the cost of the program they actually entered into. And that's what I'm remembering as I look at this, because it strikes me that we've had conversations in the last couple of days and other situations where we indeed were trying to figure out how to make something happen with a government incentive so we could indeed tax it. And I think the conversation was yesterday when we were talking about the charitable aspects of hospitals, where it's all government money flowing in. Should we tax the property where we're having those activities for which we pay with government dollars? Anyway, to get to the point, it would seem to me that in addition to addressing the but-for, it might also be of interest to see just how many of these things are actually happening, and then also so we can get some idea of the scope of this thing, and then in addition, the types of additional programs that we might not be taxing that perhaps we should be, because it's our own money is my point. And how we get there, I don't know. We'd have to go back. And this is consistent, though, Mr. Chair, forgive me for going on, but in our Energy Committee, we recently asked Are we prioritizing our state's investments appropriately? And this takes me again to your work on establishing sunsets for various tax credit programs. So there. You can blame yourself for all of this.
Well, it's a brilliant question, Representative Benz. Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. Obviously, that's a great question to ask. And I'll tell you from our let me see if I can make this concise. Part of the challenge, as the people on this committee well know, is that we have had a lot of variability in what we have put into energy efficiency programs over the years. And some of that's for good reason. We went through the trial of the Betsy, and we learned the hard way about what that means. We have since obviously scaled that back dramatically. Part of the way that I think it's important to look at it is when we look at what are the subsidies that are going in, you have ratepayer dollars and you have taxpayer dollars that are going in. You have ratepayer dollars that are going in as a investment on behalf of ratepayers that seeks to optimize energy use as sort of a proxy for purchasing new energy. And it is highly regulated by the PUC, at least in the investor-owned utility context, and it's contained within that world. And in Oregon, that's run through the Energy Trust for investor-owned utility territory. It's run through individual consumer-owned utilities outside of that area, as you well know. Then on the other side of that equation, you have what are the taxpayer resources, the tax base that's going into that, things like the Betsy, the RETC, those kinds of programs. Those have been, as you know, scaled back dramatically, and there aren't a lot of taxpayer resources that are going into those projects. And we still have ratepayer resources, incentives that go in, but those are really under that sort of that heading of their proxy investments in the energy system that theoretically, at least under PUC analysis, rebound back to the ratepayer. This is really on that taxpayer side to get these investments to happen. And I think it's while it's sort of hard to tease those two things out, I think it's important. And I can tell you, as somebody who's looking at embarking upon one of these projects, regardless of where the source is, it's majority private money that's going in here. I mean, we're not buying whole systems on behalf of people. There are incentives that you can get for buying this or that you might get from the Energy Trust or get from your local utility. There are fewer and fewer tax benefits that you can claim on it, especially in the commercial context. There's very, very little. It is really majority private money that's going into this, and more often than not, it's financed money. It's people borrowing money and paying interest on that money in order to make these upgrades.
Thank you.
Thank you. One of the issues we've been dealing with lately in this committee is the fact that many of the various tax abatements that we have done have involved counties, cities, and others in the conversation, have not involved school districts in the conversation because of the peculiar way that Oregon manages the state school fund, which all of you are familiar with. I'm wondering if, as a project, you can look into the possibility of exempting the education tax dollars from this coverage. What that would mean in terms of the assessor's work, I'm getting a look that suggests that it will be significant. Because the reality is that every dollar in property tax that goes to education assists students across the entire state, because of the way our system works. I suspect you have a response.
But before he gets to the technical aspect of it, and I bet you can guess what the response will be, I do want to just frame, I think the question is a very good one, and it gets again to Representative Whitsett's question, Mr. Chair, about what's the potential of the lost revenue here. I will borrow a line, Mr. Chair, from Representative Reed in his wisdom. I don't think you coined it, but you could take credit for it. Is the juice worth the squeeze?
No, he didn't coin it.
I took that from your colleague, Chris Fick.
Well, there we go. All right. Is the juice worth the squeeze? I think it's important. I think it's important to remember that what we're talking about here is that increment just on energy efficiency on projects that are being done. We don't have an estimate for you right now, and I wish we did, of exactly what that would mean in terms of property tax revenue, because we're projecting forward on projects that may or might not have happened. But I can tell you with a fair amount of assurance, this is not a lot of money that we're talking about here, because this is just a small, small fraction of the upgrades that are happening. It might make a big difference to a property owner that's trying to make it pencil right on the margin and make the zeros line up, but to a county government, it's really not that much money.
Chair Barnhart, to your question, the aspect of creating a partial exemption on an account for taxing districts is, while not impossible, extremely burdensome. And while it's burdensome to my county, it is a large hill to climb for small counties. What you actually need to do, because of our unsegregated tax account and how we do things in Oregon, is you'd have to set up separate accounts and separate levy codes on each property. So you can bundle some properties into their own levy code, but then you have to create two accounts for that property, and you manage them that way. Then you have appeal issues. And at this moment, we've been successful, even though there are some statutes out there. Recently, I was talking with my staff and other assessors that if we could do anything, it'd be to come back and say, if something is good enough public policy, we would really love to take every reference in statutes to partial tax exemptions out. There's ones in there for, I believe it's adult foster homes, to they can go after they get their certification to each taxing district and get that taxing district to sign off that they abate those taxes. That's a nightmare for us. And we actually, to a degree, while we could do it, it'd be very expensive in that example. That's just one example. And while I'm here for technical aspects, I'm going to just throw in a little aspect on policy. I've been thinking about this type of thing for years and have been excited that Commissioner Bailey is now at Multnomah County, because I've been an appraiser for well over 30 years. And many of our communities, I know Portland the best, have a housing and building stock that is great but deteriorating. And we see many jobs that come through, and why didn't they do more? And I think Representative Davis referenced that. And so we're at a critical point where we don't have additional lots in Portland to build, so there's a lot to retrofit jobs that need to be done. And many times we don't see all that could be done being done.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from the Home Performance Guild next. And I said it that way because one of the names is illegible, despite our request for legibility. Please, not yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name, even when I spell it correctly, is illegible. My name is Stephen Cafori. I represent the Home Performance Contractors Guild of Oregon. We are a group of home remodelers who specialize in retrofitting homes for energy efficiency. And as the word performance there, you heard this earlier from Commissioner Bailey, it also has to do with making sure that the air is clean and pure to breathe, and that the houses are comfortable. So performance is a broader term than just merely energy efficiency, although our main focus is on energy efficiency. We're the ones who brought this bill to Representative Vega Peterson, and we're very appreciative of her. Sorry that she's not well today. I wanted to introduce Don McOdram, who is our executive director, and he can tell you about what we do, the benefits we haven't talked about yet in terms of jobs. I'm sure he'd like to say what's happening with the industry as a result of the energy efficiency programs that we're doing now, and how we're concerned about as much not losing momentum as we are gaining new work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. McCullough.
Thank you. And
for the record,
Mr. Chair, Don McCullough from the Executive Director of the Home Performance Guild of Oregon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. And thank you for nailing my name perfectly.
I was listening carefully.
Just for the record, we strongly support House Bill 3246. The Home Performance Guild of Oregon is a 501c6 nonprofit trade association. We are based in Portland, but we serve all of Oregon. We have membership all across Oregon, and it's made up of the contractors who do the upgrades to homes. They look at the house as a system, and they determine how all those components are working together to improve the comfort, health and safety, and efficiency for all the occupants. We are a... it's a group, so it's made up of those contractors. It's made up of programs such as Energy Trust of Oregon, Clean Energy Works Oregon, that help direct incentives to support these upgrades. It's made up of the manufacturers, local manufacturers such as Indo Windows. It's made up of the distributors and banks who lend to these programs, to these upgrades, to the homeowners. And many others. We're, as a trade association, we are a cross-section of the industry. We are locally owned companies, and we employ local workers throughout Oregon. The need for energy efficiency is not something that I'll necessarily cover here today. I think each one of the representatives have their own value judgments on its need, and I certainly have a strong belief that it's something that we should be doing at every opportunity. Not at every, not at any cost, but through intelligent policy. Ideally, our market, our industry, would like to have market-based incentives. It's nice to have tax credits to tell homeowners about. It's nice to have ratepayer incentives to tell homeowners about. But ideally, homeowners see the value. They understand it. You know, when you go to buy a home. Such as Jules, former Representative Jules Bailey and Commissioner Bailey, you ask about the insulation, you ask about the age of the furnace, and you understand the value of having these efficient features in the home, or understand the lack of value of not having insulation in the walls and having a leaky home. But that's not necessarily the world that we live in. We want to move to the point where when somebody goes to sell their home, they can see a return on investment of any energy efficiency upgrades that they've made. Time of sale valuation of home performance is ultimately our goal. One of the stepping stones for that was 2013 House Bill 2801, put forward by our own former representative, Jules Bailey. And put forward by the Home Performance Guild of Oregon, part of a series of steps that we saw to help move it to the market. A home energy performance score, which is quoted or that is referenced in Section 1B, sometimes some people do not like the relating it to a miles per gallon, but it's an energy rating. It rates the consumption, and it's absolute. It sets standard operating with a average occupancy, and things that improve the score, and zero being a perfect score. Zero meaning that you're not using any energy, or at least you're using as much energy as you're producing on the home, for example through solar panels. The things that reduce that score are clearly measurable, and those are the things that are cited here. There was a question here earlier on today about what are the things that can reduce that score. Well, they're mapped out through these tools. Having these home energy performance scores out in the market, one of the reasons we originally approached the Multnomah County was because we saw an opportunity to not just have these scores out there, but to have them live somewhere that homeowners will be able to see them easily. County tax records was one area that we were thinking about. The RMLS, that's a relationship that we've been working on as well. Any other ways that we can get this to surface for appraisers and realtors during the transaction. One of the other ways that we can move this to the market is by having by helping the market understand that it has value, that these upgrades have value, is removing these disincentives while we're talking about the value that it adds to the home. This is if these homes are receiving these upgrades and a homeowner says, all right, well, then if it increases value, then I'm sure it'll increase my taxes. Well, that's a conversation that slows a transaction down at a time when we need to be making these investments. We need to be helping homeowners spend their money to make these investments in our collective infrastructure. I've got a few other things that I could say, but I'd be happy to answer questions if you like.
Thank you, and I appreciate that because we are short of time. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
I came in late, and I apologize for that. Was insulation one of the things that was considered energy efficiency by reinsulating a home?
Yes. So, for example, I just mentioned that the Home Energy Performance Score standard that was created that's now being run by the Oregon Department of Energy and uses various tools. One is Energy Trust EPS score. Adding insulation to a home is something that will reduce the score in so much as means that it reduces the consumption of energy in that home. It saves energy.
So is the answer yes, it would be then, if that's the only thing that you do?
The energy performance, I don't want to evade the question. Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, excuse me. The way I wanted to answer that question was to say that a score is normalized for regular occupancy, weather, etc. So if a individual person, a real person, is using their home in such a way that they are not realizing energy savings on their bills, and they have installed insulation in a way that is to the standards that installation specifications that we know is going to be effective, then it could be an occupancy, a different way of using the home. But yes, it is universally regarded as something that saves energy.
And so it would be covered under this bill. Would you have to have someone come in and measure the energy efficiency first and then measure it after you've put the insulation in? And I'm asking this because we had a home, an older home, and that's what we did, and it cut the energy consumption by 50% by completely redoing, but we did nothing else other than completely re-insulate the house. So would something like that be covered? Or do you have to go through a whole process? How is the appraiser going to determine that you've re-insulated, because it's not evident that you've done it, because it's in places you can't see?
Right. So the Representative Chair Barnhart and Representative Whitsitt, the legislation is written such that there has to be an application to the assessor's offices. That describe the upgrades that are going to be taking place. So they will list the measures that are being installed that are going to contribute to the savings in energy.
Before. So all this is predicated on doing something before you do it and getting the approval of your appraiser before you do this. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. I have three more witnesses who would like to be heard today. Jody Weiser, Tracy Rutan, and John Phillips, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutan with the League of Oregon Cities, here today on behalf of Oregon's 242 cities. Wanting to express some of the concerns and questions that we have with this bill, many of which the committee has voiced today. They're similar questions to what we have had as we've read through the language of the bill. Mainly our concerns are how this program would be implemented, as well as the potential revenue impacts to cities. I'm sure that this committee has heard it before, but 60% of city revenue is derived from property tax revenue. So the impact, obviously, not being just to cities, but also to schools, as well as counties and special districts as well. We do also have a concern and see that there is potential to scale this program back. We do think that 10 years seems like an awful long time for the program and for the abatement. One of the other concerns that has come up is a revenue shift off to other taxpayers. If there is a levy that's been passed in a community, obviously there is a need to collect that revenue regardless of how that gets paid. So if there are significant investments that are being made, let's say by a commercial builder for their property, then that revenue burden still exists and needs to be passed on to other taxpayers in the community. So that would be a concern that we have. Other concerns that we have, I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about this being tools for local governments, which we certainly do like to see tools. We often talk about another tool in the toolbox for local government, and that's a great thing. Except for when those tools are mandated for us to have to be abiding by and potentially seeing revenue impacts as a result of that. We would be interested in looking at a potential opt-out provision for those who maybe are not so enthusiastic about this or have some significant revenue concerns or implementation concerns for those counties that might not be able to go through the process of this type of an assessment or have concerns about the implementation overall. Finally, we'd like to be a part of the conversation going forward. It sounds to me like there are a lot of conversations that are ongoing about how this program would work and how it would be implemented. We'd like to be at that table and be a part of that discussion going forward and would appreciate that opportunity. And finally, we'd like to see the revenue impact for this bill because, quite frankly, we really just don't know what that impact would look like for the cities that we represent. So I thank you for your time and happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you.
So, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon, our concerns are very similar. We notice there's no sunset or goal statement for the bill or for the other bill we're planning on hearing today. And it seems like, you know, in 2009 when the Revenue Restructuring Task Force reported back, they said reduce the restrictions on local government's ability to raise revenue and refrain from new property tax exemptions or state mandates on local government. This recommendation is directed at the legislature and essentially says do no harm that will make local government's fiscal situation worse. It would seem that if we don't have the subsidies right, and there are some situations where it's a but-for thing, then the dollars need to be figured out by the Energy Trust of Oregon and the Department of Energy, not by a tax program that would exempt a project, whether it was but-for or not. And I think also there's just a lot of things that are going on where this would be, particularly with a requirement that you apply ahead of time, probably only the best connected are going to know to use this program instead of the broader range of people in the state. And so it would end up benefiting those who are best connected to what the resources of the state are rather than the people who maybe are most in need.
Thank you. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. The department is neutral on this bill. We just have one challenge that we wanted to point out to you. I think our challenge resonates with a question that Representative Johnson asked earlier, and that is, what kinds of things does this exemption consider? And if you look in line 23, it has the department, appears to have the department spelling out those kinds of things that might be considered because it says, that the department will be writing rules on descriptions of energy efficient improvements that qualify. And I have to admit, we probably do not have the expertise within our agency to do that. And so that would be a challenge for us to come up with that. There were several references to the solar bill, the solar language for the law that this was patterned after, and that is 307-175. And it does say for alternative energy systems that are basically, that means geothermal, wind, solar, fuel cell, methane gas, and it lists the kinds of things, and then it says what it would be used for. And that's maybe a helpful example of the kinds of changes that would maybe focus the bill a little bit, and the assessors and the appraisers out there would be able to see it and identify it. So I thank you for that.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your testimony, especially from the cities, and the word you used in there, I think, was a cost shift or revenue shift, or
And I guess what I'm going to get at is I think this relates to Representative Dentz's line of questioning earlier, in that we could be creating a situation here where there could be multiple stacking of, i.e. tax credits and or tax abatements on a particular, this is primarily on a residential site. I refer to the net metering program that is currently able to, that exists where homeowners can put solar panels on their homes. It enables their meter to run backwards, if you will. They don't actually contribute anything to the base maintenance of the system itself. They use the grid as a battery, if you will, to use when the sun's not shining, which, you know, we like that. It works. But the point is, it results in a shift to those ratepayers who aren't able to invest in those systems and so forth. But this seems to me that it's even in a further where you could be getting the tax credits to put your solar panels on your roof. You get the check back from the utility because you're able to participate in that program, and you're getting a property tax abatement to boot. That concerns me, because those who can't afford that or don't have the means to think creatively about that are the people that end up holding the bag. And then we inevitably get a bill coming back looking for low-income rate assistance the next session, because I've seen it happen now. So that, yeah, I appreciate your testimony to kind of raise that awareness of what we could be creating here. And I don't think any of us want to do that, but we just need to have our eyes wide open about all of the other measures out there that are trying to incentivize good behavior, if you will, and what the sum total of that could mean. So thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3246 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3125. Is that also yours?
Yes.
Okay. You want to give us an update, and we
get the sheet.
That'd be good. Thanks.
Yes, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3125, what it would do, it would expand an existing property tax exemption for qualified machinery and equipment used in the food processing, and the expansion would include machinery and equipment used to process grains, bakery products, milk, and eggs. There was previously an exemption for egg processing that did sunset 6/30/2012, just for a little background there. The bill will modify its definitions related to food processor and qualified machinery and equipment, and adds the definition of qualified processing activity to include the packing of food for human consumption. It does some statute cleanup. It repeals the statutes related to the expired egg processing equipment exemption, and it would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015. And just a note on that, that would be past the at this point, we'd be past the deadline to apply for the, or initially apply for the exemption. So anyone who would apply for it for July, after July 1st, 2015, for this upcoming tax year, would pay $200 to file a late filing to receive the exemption.
Great, thank you. I know we have a large number of people. I'm going to call the first panel and then make a comment. Ian Tollison, Mary Stern, John Greeley, please. I note I've got, I think, 10 people to testify today. We have about 35 minutes. I apologize for the other bill taking so much time. So be aware of that as we go ahead. And so be as succinct as you can, and hopefully we can get questions in as well. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be as quickly as I can. My name is Ian Tollison. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Northwest Food Processors Association. We are made up of fruit, vegetable, seafood, nut, and legume processors and eggs. We basically are the ones that take the raw products from Oregon's farms, package it, and sell it. You can find our products in any supermarket, convenience store, or restaurant, or anywhere else that sells packaged food. We come to you today in support of House Bill 3125, but I'll start just with some brief history here. This bill really builds upon a successful program first enacted in 2005 by Senate Bill 479. At that time, our industry was reeling from plant closures and declining employment numbers. From 2002 to 2003, we saw a 15% decline in the average annual employment. To combat this, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 479 that allowed fruit, vegetable, seafood, nut, and legume processors to claim a five-year personal property tax exemption for newly acquired machinery and equipment. Despite being in the middle of a recession, Oregon's food processing industry rebounded, and we grew employment 7.8% from 2007 to 2012. We attribute some of this job growth directly to the machinery and equipment, or M&E tax exemption. When the exemption was set to expire in 2013, again, the Oregon legislature came in and extended that to the year 2020 by House Bill 2735. Food processing companies have now seen this exemption in place for 10 years. Whether we knew it at the time or not, the existence of this exemption has made Oregon a competitive state for food processing. Many of our facilities throughout the Northwest are aging and need to be updated to remain competitive. And just as a note, in 2009, NWFPA was the first industry group in the U.S. to set an industry-wide goal to reduce our energy intensity by 25% in 10 years and 50% in 20 years. The industry is on track to meet this goal. Food processors has also adopted greenhouse gas emission reductions to target it in their sustainability programs. And I'm happy to report that we are on track to meet that, and this exemption will greatly help replace our equipment in order to get us there. The intent of House Bill 3125 is to simply expand an already successful program. This would include four additional industry sectors, that is grains, bakery, dairy, and egg processors. This is just a five-year exemption on your personal and property tax to the county. The Oregon Department of Revenue has estimated a depreciation rate of about 6% a year. That means that when the equipment is back on the county tax roll on year six, it is taxed roughly at 70% of its taxable value, which is fairly well. The tax benefit will allow these businesses to reinvest and grow their operations here in Oregon rather than somewhere else. And I just would like to say this is a very appropriate time for expanded state and local public policy support for our industry. The food industry faces a period of sustained growth opportunities. It's really a rare time that firms that innovate and retool for the future will be rewarded. And I'll just briefly say there's about five reasons for this. The U.S. and many other countries are emerging from a deep economic recession, and food processing is entering a time of growth to catch up for that. And these consumption rates will really require food processors to invest in their businesses to remain competitive. Two, the Asian Pacific region, of course, led by China, is distinguished as the epicenter of food demand. This is fueled by the region's large population base and income growth. Oregon has great advantages than many other parts of the U.S. In reaching this growth market. Concerns over food safety are turning buyers' attention to U.S.-made food. It's safer than many developing countries, and the recent Federal Food Safety Modernization Act will raise the cost of U.S. manufacturing in the short term, but this is expected to create an advantage for U.S. foods over lower quality foods detected elsewhere. And, of course, Oregon has a high value on their environmental and sustainability standards. And this will be very helpful as consumers increasingly want to processors to meet this higher standard. And Oregon can extend its national leadership in this regard. And lastly, the technology on the horizon for food processors to meet this competition and growth is ever-changing, and we'll need to reinvest. And I would just like to say these investments are going to happen. The only question is where. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that this is going to light the entire Oregon food processing industry on fire and we're going to have huge growth, but it will help. It will help greatly. You know, there are many factors that determine where a company makes their investment, but I will say that this will be a large incentive to these four industry sectors to keep their operations here in Oregon. The 2002 closure of the Deluxe ice cream plant here in Salem is a really good example where costs to upgrading a facility can sometimes be too much for that company to afford. When the plant closed, it took with it 75 jobs. This M&E exemption would have greatly enabled that company to reinvest in their new machinery and equipment to remain competitive. In fact, the owner cited that being a key factor in the closure. You know, finally, I will leave you with two examples of investments in Idaho that it really illustrate what kind of economic development opportunities are available. Chobani brought $450 million in investments and 500 jobs. And Cliff Bar made a $90 million investment and 250 jobs in Twin Falls recently. The state of Oregon should be asking themselves, what can they do to attract this kind of investment here? I would submit to you that these policies, such as the one in House Bill 3125, should be a part of the overall strategy to attract food processors here in Oregon. These industries have identified this exemption as a great tool to help them remain competitive and keep their jobs here in Oregon, and I greatly ask for your support. And I will say, Mr. Chair, just for the record, there has been some discussion between Department of Revenue and Department of Agriculture on the drafting of the legislation. There were some aspects that were cleaned up and moved around for the drafter, and I just want to state for the record that these small changes in language aren't intended to change the program in any way. These are to just extend the current program that is working and to extend that to bakeries, dairies, egg processors, and people that mill grain. In other words, machinery and equipment will now be able to claim the exemption once this bill is passed, and that is the intent of the bill.
Thank you. One of the things that would be useful in writing later would be what Idaho used in terms of incentives in order to get those plants you described to come to Idaho. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Mary Stern, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. And AOC does support House Bill 3125. AOC believes that local governments play a crucial role in economic development in our state. And as you heard from Wendy Johnson from LOC, we do struggle with that, trying to balance the costs and the benefits between these business incentives. But with the support of House Bill 3125, counties are willing to give up a portion of property tax revenues on new investment in the short term because it is beneficial to our communities in the long term. House Bill 3125 expands on an existing tax exemption which has proven successful over the past decade, and we want to see more of that. Since 2005, the food processing industry has seen significant increases in annual employment and in total payroll. Much of that growth has been in the rural areas where it's desperately needed. Expanding this proven incentive will allow Oregon to compete with neighboring states. As you heard from Ian, Chobani, and Cliff Bar, what if they had located here? What would that have meant to, say, Malheur County? Additionally, the expansion of the exemption provides incentives to companies like Tillamook Creamery, who are looking out 5 years and they want to stay in this community and make investments and grow jobs in Oregon. And it should be noted that property tax exemption is only on newly acquired machinery and equipment. Companies benefiting from this exemption continue to pay property taxes on their land, on buildings, and other equipment. We anticipate the exempted machinery and equipment will come back onto the tax rolls after the 5 years at approximately 70% of its original value, meaning that local governments will eventually see an increase in revenues as a result of the original investment. In order to encourage economic growth throughout Oregon, we ask for your support of House Bill 3125. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is John Greeley. I'm the CFO at NORPAC Foods, and just here to speak as an organization who has been using property tax exemption and how it's affected NORPAC. We certainly see the value. We are always investing in plant and equipment, and with the just added challenges in our industry when it comes to being innovative, harnessing new technologies, food safety, things like this property tax exemption and the tax savings that it creates for us certainly incentivizes us to continue to spend those dollars in Oregon, continue to be a big supplier of the labor workforce for Oregon, and it certainly helps us in what we're trying to achieve in being a food processor and food manufacturer.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Smith-Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you all for this. I know I've gotten other information about this beforehand, and I thank you for your thoroughness in that. I actually just have a quick question about that, about the deluxe ice cream plant. Did it open somewhere else? Did it just close, period? Kind of what's the current status of that?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Smith-Warner and Chair Barnhart. You know, I'm not sure I can follow up with you and make sure you have that information. What we did a couple years ago prior to my coming to the association is we surveyed our membership to ask them, you know, what is helpful, what would be helpful to your business. And that's how we found out that this plant closure was here, and they cited that the expensive machinery and equipment. So I don't know if they went elsewhere, but I can certainly check into that and get back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Whitsitt, please.
Thank you. I think generally I like the bill, but I have a question about would bakeries that are, for example, like National in a Safeway store, Albertson's store, are we talking about exempting the bakeries in these national food chains that are in the stores, or are you talking about something like France Bakery that has a big facility that, you know, I mean, when I look at the list, bakery foods are highly processed, and so almost everything else that you have on the list is pretty much in its elemental form, if you will, you know, food form, but bakeries aren't. And so I'm curious, would this apply to that sort of thing, like Great Harvest Bread is a national chain and Safeways and Albertsons, and so have you thought about that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, thanks for the question. The definition we use for bakery, and I think it's 625.010, it has a standard of products sold on the premises. So if you just sold it for human consumption on the premises, I don't think it would qualify the way that I read it. But you would have to be able to package it and take the food somewhere else to be used, to be eligible for the exemption.
Okay. So if they're baking it on site then and selling it on site, that would be excluded from this then?
So, yeah, if I understand, if you are baking it on site and you can eat it on site, then you would be unable to claim the exemption. But if you are also selling those products to be packaged, then they would be eligible for the exemption.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson, then Representative Bentz.
Thanks, Ian, for your work here. And I want to make the point, I think that you know, the food processing industry, I think, is really one of the faces of the new ag industry within Oregon as we talk about value-added products. And we've got some incredible companies doing some amazing work, locally sourced products that are just incredibly popular in and outside of Oregon. I've got two in my district, one would be Everfresh outside of Sandy, almost in Boring, and then Hooter Juice Company, who are also just major employers in our communities as well. You know, and they're innovative companies. They're building wonderfully energy efficient buildings and putting in the best equipment they can. They're good players. So I'd love to do everything we can do to, you know, facilitate and encourage that sort of expansion and growth as we go forward. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr.
Question?
I have a question.
Thanks.
So the question is why is this different than other types of manufacturing and processing across the state of Oregon? That's the question. Why should we call out food processing and give it this type of protection? And I think in our conversations before, Ian, we've talked about the competition we're facing now from South America and other places, which perhaps don't enjoy a lot of the protections we afford those who work up here in our fields and elsewhere. Thus, the types of things we're doing for people working in our plants far exceed the benefit that perhaps those in other countries enjoy. And I think what you and I concluded was that this was one of those efforts to try to make us more globally competitive. Is that correct, or am I missing what we discussed a month ago?
Yeah, Mr. Bentz, Chair Barnhart. Yeah, I mean, the name of the game is competition. We are in a very, very competitive industry. Whether it's competing from state to state or outside of the United States. So this will definitely help be able to get us into a spot where we can continue and thrive and have our businesses located in Oregon. Now, I would submit to you that, you know, the policy decision of where else you go from food is your area, but food is mine, and I know that it will definitely help ours. I would venture to say it would probably help others as well, but I know that we've had this exemption in for the last 10 years, and it has helped our industry, the ones that currently have it. So that's why we're trying to broaden it out to others that currently do not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Did I get through? Yes, Representative Davis, you're next.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. And thank you very much for your testimony. I understand the exemption under current law is 5 years. It would remain the same. What's the average life of a piece of machinery purchased? Or is there?
Representative Davis, Chair Barnhart, you know, I have a member here who actually works in these plants. If you don't mind, I think I will allow him to answer. He'll probably sound much smarter than I.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Davis, it can be 15 to 20, 25 years, just depending on the piece of equipment that you might be talking about.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
So we're not talking about a piece of equipment that you'll use for 4.5 years under the exemption, purchase a new one at 4 years, 11 months, purchase a new one after 4 years, 11 months. These are typically the equipment you have lasts for quite a long time, a generation, it sounds like.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis, yes, that is correct. We're talking about long-lived assets that generate something. We see that value of delaying that property tax, that 5 years, and still being able to put on an asset and pay property tax on it of, you know, 60% value or plus. So
thank you.
Hopefully that answers your question.
Other questions? I note that we do have a panel of other people with specific businesses that you may want to ask questions of as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Let's go on to them. Panel number two, Willamette Ag, Shepherd's Grain, the Grain Millers, the Grain Millers. You notice I carefully avoided having to pronounce anybody's name. Thank you. And I know we only have a few minutes left today, and I have some other people to hear from, so if you can be succinct, that would be very helpful to us. Thank you. Please go ahead. State your name for the record and then give your testimony.
Yeah, good afternoon. Greg Satram with Willamette Egg Farms. We're an 81-year-old company located here in Canby, Oregon, third-generation egg farmer myself. I will be brief. Don't worry. So the portion of our business that this directly affects is our further processed value-added egg products, and which is actually a pretty it's a good story in sustainability. So when we're delivering eggs into Washington and Northern California, we're looking for backhauls. We don't like to run empty trucks. It's a waste of fuel. So what we do is we pick up about 1 million eggs a day from competitors that are sometimes surplus eggs, eggs with shell defects. We bring them back to our plant here in Oregon, and we process those into pasteurized liquid eggs, hard-cooked eggs, and we supply companies like Reesers, Oregon Freeze Dry, with those products as inputs into the food that they're making. So it's a pretty significant portion of our business, about 30% of our sales and about 30% of our jobs. We employ 215 people. So currently, you know, we do need to make regular investments in our equipment to stay competitive. Large competitors in this segment, primarily in Iowa, we compete against some big farms back there. So this bill is helpful for us. We're currently looking at putting in a new breaking machine, which is a significant expense. So it definitely helps us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, my name is Mike Moran. I'm with Shepherd's Grain, Columbia Plateau Producers. We're a grower-owned company based out of Washington, Idaho, and Oregon in terms of our grower base and our owner base. We started about 12 years ago marketing sustainable, identity-preserved wheat and flour in the Northwest. And so our history is we've primarily partnered with other processors who do our work for us, most recently actually with Grain Millers, who does oats for our farmers. As the demand for local foods has increased, particularly identity preserved, sustainable, traceable, we're finding that a lot of the crops that we grow that make our farm sustainable, not just wheat, but the other seeds and grains, there isn't existing infrastructure capacity to do that. And so we're actually endeavoring in opening our own facility. We just completed a comprehensive feasibility study and economic impact analysis. And really our choice is Washington, Idaho, Oregon, primarily. This would be a big incentive for us to locate in Oregon. There are a lot of we're primarily looking at the Port of Morrow in Boardman as an Oregon location. It's got a lot of attractive aspects for locating there. But in talking with the ports in Washington and Idaho as well, everybody wants our business to move there. Ideally, I'd like to see us locate in Boardman for a lot of reasons. This really represents for us one of those tipping points in making that kind of a decision. When we look at the direct and indirect impacts, economic impacts, we're looking at 13 direct jobs that we'd be creating and direct impact, $4.5 to $5 million of economic impact just in the state of Oregon. If you look more comprehensively across the Northwest, we're looking about a $10.5 million economic impact. We really like to locate here. This represents something that's not a make or break, will we open or not open? It really is something that's going to influence our decisions of where to open. We are going to do this. It's just a question of where. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Grain Millers.
Yes, thank you. My name is Pat Shannon. I'm here with Jonah Nickerson from Grain Millers, Inc. It's a oat milling facility that originated in 1984 down in Eugene, Oregon. To answer your question about are these facilities around for a long time, our mill was, I believe, started in the 30s or the 20s as a racehorse oat milling facility. We bought it in 84, converted it to a human consumption oat mill. And since that point in time, 1984, the company has grown to be the largest industrial supplier of oats in North America. We now have mills in Saskatchewan. We have them in Iowa. We have them various places around the country where we grow oats, mostly grown in Canada, bring them in and mill them in our locations where we can serve our individual customers, which are industrial customers. We have about 100 employees here in Oregon, and we have about 500 employees nationally. I also am a board member of United States Bakeries, which is one of the largest, largest family baking companies in the United States and North America. We have around 3,500 employees in the total company and about 800 here in Oregon. We both are similar in companies where we have old facilities that need to be upgraded. We've upgraded them to the point where we can't really upgrade them anymore. They're also landlocked. In Eugene, we're landlocked. In Portland, we're landlocked. In Eugene, we had to move into Springfield because we were landlocked at the University of Oregon. When we make an investment in these facilities, as we're currently looking at doing, we purchased 100 acres outside of Eugene by the airport to hopefully reinvest in a brand new oat milling facility. That's an $80 million proposition. A bakery is similar, $60 million proposition in Eugene when we had to relocate the bakery. But those bakeries and these oat mills will be around for, 100 years. We'll buy this equipment and then we'll completely rebuild it, and we'll rebuild it and rebuild it. And then improve on that equipment as necessary, but that equipment is used extensively over the course of decades. This particular bill will definitely help us. We're considering, do we relocate our mill in Eugene or upgrade the mill in Eugene into this new facility, or also looking at improving our facility in Saskatchewan. We've been looking at improving a mill or building a new facility in the Midwest. So for us, this represents something that will be significant for us. We want to keep our presence here in Oregon, and this is where our roots are, and this is one of those opportunities that gives us some incentive to do so.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and representatives, for the record, I'm Jonah Nickerson with Grain Millers out of Eugene. At this time, I don't actually have anything to add because of time permitting, but I'm here in support of hopefully 3125 passing, and it would mean a great deal to our company and adding dollars back in and creating jobs and solidifying our customer base on the West Coast. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have about Grain Millers or our possible expansion.
Thank you very much. We have a bunch of experts. Now's your chance. Start with Representative Davis and then move this way.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. Just and maybe in follow-up, you can email us, but we'd be fascinated to know, to follow up on the Chair's question, what Washington and Idaho are offering you to go to those locations.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that's I found hugely valuable about food processing is the fact that it generally means that you've got a lot of local farmers and others that supply materials to you, so the processing is just one part of that value-added chain. Is that true for your businesses?
Well, interestingly enough, for Grain Millers, most of our supply has moved from the Willamette Valley up to Canada. We've been pushed out by the other people here in the room that have more value-added ingredients that can be grown here in this state, but we do touch a number of other industries, trucking, rail. We have, you know, our construction companies. I mean, we employ only 100 employees, but we also support maybe 100 companies with what we do in this state. So our impact is not only to the growers, but it's also to a variety of industries that we do business with here.
Just to follow up,
please, yeah.
Something that would be hugely helpful to us would be for you guys to show us that type of a valuable link in this chain of other businesses, because that's huge for us here. Yeah. And I know over in Ontario, we recently had a 375-job factory onion processing facility move out of Idaho into Oregon. And that's huge because there's so many onion farmers there that supply the onions to that facility. So it's it builds on itself, and we need to know if that's the case for you folks.
If I may, Vice Chair Benz, as we're looking at the economic impact, and I'll be happy to share through email some of the results that we came when we looked at the more comprehensively that impact. Right now, we represent 18 owners, but 48 growers total in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and that number is growing. One of the unique models that we started 12 years ago when we started our company is that all of our farmers are paid basis cost of production, reasonable rate of return. As an inherent part of developing sustainable agricultural practices, we can't rely on commodity pricing because it does not usually reward agriculture. And so when we look at the economic impact analysis, we're increasing the number of acres by doing that direct value-added identity preservation. That's why we really want to continue to build that basis here. We're getting interest from other parts of the country. I think we will locate in the Northwest no matter what. It's an inherent part of who we are. But it is not just the delivery of value directly back to the farm. 68% of a bag of flour, 68% of the value of a bag of our flour goes directly to the farm, which is pretty unique in the flour industry. Okay. And as we move into these other crops, we want to maintain that same kind of impact. But as Pat said, it also extends into trucking. Directly, we'll employ 13 people. Indirectly and induced, we're looking at more like 70 to 75 jobs that would be created by this new facility.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I missed Representative Reed. Oh, you didn't have a question? Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Gentlemen, any additional information you can provide to us in writing to the committee staff about the questions that Representative Benz just asked, I think we would appreciate. I'm aware that one of the goals that we generally have for Oregon agriculture is the increase in Oregon branding and value added. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you're all working in that area along in the specific niches that you're working in. Mm-hmm. I'm getting head nods, so I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Philip Kennedy Wong, Joel Fisher, and Wendy Johnson. And they all have different things to say, but they're the last three. Is Mr. Kennedy Wong here? I guess he's not. Okay.
All right, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We have been working on agricultural issues for a while. We brought together a really interesting group that we've been working with for over a year, chaired by Patrick Kreitzer of Tillamook Creamery, Sam Tannehill of A to Z Wine Works, working closely with the Oregon Business Council, with the Northwest Food Processors Association, looking at some of the economic data that that Ian Tolleson from the Food Processors already showed you, where during the recession, you know, all the industry clusters really go down, and value-added agriculture just sails on through. We coined the term, it was recession-proof. There's a lot of comparative advantages that we have. I've got some testimony I'm passing around that shows you the global middle class right now, where it stands and where it's set to grow. We're going to see huge gains in China and India, which we are positioned close to. So this group has thought of a whole lot of ideas around things that we can be doing as a state to really move the ball forward with value-added agriculture. This is one of those, and we are here to urge your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League would agree that this bill does promote economic development, but we have to be the one naysayer apparently in the room, because with economic development and the way it does it through this bill, it's a property tax exemption. And as you know, cities rely 60%, as you heard on the previous bill, on property taxes. And so it's, I have the awkward spot of having both economic development portfolio and revenue portfolio. And so it, the way it's set up in Oregon with our tax system of being not diverse, anytime a property tax exemption is provided, it puts, there's no backfill to help cities pay their bills and provide services and infrastructure. So that's our main concern. In short, every time you provide an exemption in the law, that is a cut for us. And those millions keep adding up. Last session, in the 2013 session, you extended the food processing exemption, or the sunset. It was set to expire in 2013, and it was extended to 2020. So in your expenditure report that you have, we know that that exemption was worth $2.4 million as a revenue loss for schools, cities, and counties, and special districts. If you add to that exemption, which is what this bill would do, we know that's going to be more than $2.4 million a year or biennium loss. So that's what we're looking at. I've got some specific questions on the bill as well. The bill clearly adds grain and bakery to the list for food processing. We know from past experience that the egg issue was litigated on what that all included, and so we're concerned that we're not sure how expansive grain, what that covers. There's not a lot of detail of what all equipment would be covered, so it's just throwing that out there. The bakery issue is, Representative Whitsitt mentioned that question as well. It lists the bakery product definition that's in existing law, but it doesn't have the bakery definition also listed. So we have that same concern of which bakery products does it include, because bakery product is like cookies and pies and such. So
Representative Whitsitt's question.
Correct. Great. So it does reference bakery product, but doesn't have bakery. The bill also, in the summary, says that it adds eggs. The egg processing exemption had been in existing law, and it's still there. It expired in 2012, but because of the five-year usage, it actually will go to 2017 for those companies that had the equipment. But what was unique about the egg processing exemption is that it was a local opt-in. You'll see in the statute that each city or county could decide to provide that. We prefer that option because yes, it does allow local governments to decide whether they want to compete to get that business there, make sure they have the right infrastructure, can provide services. The food processing exemption
does
not
have. And the bill does repeal that particular possibility, doesn't it?
Right. Chair Barnhart, basically it just moves the egg. They're right in statute right after each other. Egg was right after the food processing. It deletes all the egg processing exemptions and puts it into the list with food processing. So the local opt-in is gone. It would just be a straight exemption period.
Right.
So we prefer keeping that exemption the way it has been. And then it also adds milk products, is what the summary says. And I'm not sure how that works with existing law, because there's already a dairying exemption in existing law, so we're not sure what the milk exemption does. The dairying provision is in 307.394. So we're not sure. You know, milk seems to obviously be a dairying product, so we're not sure what that difference is. Our point is that anytime you do a property tax exemption for economic development purposes, the state has no skin in the game. It's purely local governments and schools. You know that issue from GainShare and SIP. We feel like this is just another top opportunity for us to say we really need property tax reform and we really need economic development reform. We don't want to oppose the bill. I mean, we know that it promotes jobs as well. It's economic development, but it just keeps pointing out the problem we have every time we do an exemption. We have to think about how we're going to prioritize exemptions and how that affects local governments and schools. One positive thing is that it is a five-year exemption, unlike some of the exemptions. The bill you heard previously was 10 years. So at least it's 5 years. It will come back on the tax rolls. That's a positive thing. But again, we would just prefer that it be a local opt-in rather than a straight across the board, which allows an agreement and work with local government. And for that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for these two? I won't say panel because they're not in the same spot. I've been whispering to staff while you've been talking because I think we do need to get answers to those kinds of questions. And while you're all still here, I have to say that the key for this committee passing this kind of a bill is really the but-for question. We deal with a bunch of property tax exemptions or set-offs or we'll not charge you for a while kinds of things. Usually there's a really good reason why we should do that. An asset which is very, very expensive, which depreciates very quickly, and which will absolutely not come to Oregon if we tax it. And a variety of other kinds of things. I think that in order to move this one forward, we really need to understand better why this particular tax exemption is essential. And I think it would be really useful if those who proposed this could explain why it is that we need to repeal the opt-in that the cities refer to. The bill does repeal that piece of the statute involving eggs, and I wonder why we shouldn't simply apply that to all of these new things that we're talking about. So if we could have that in writing in the next little bit, that would be helpful to us. Anything else? Thank you. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3125. Colleagues, I'm going to carry over the work sessions until tomorrow. That we're getting into a habit, and I'd like to break that habit. The work sessions that I'm carrying over are House Bill 2128, 2127, 2129, 2131, and 2148. Paul, have I said what I need to? I have. Thank you. With that, the committee is adjourned.